Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, in what I'm calling the third best tournament of the season at the FedEx St. Jude Championship, Justin Rose prevailed in a three-hole playoff over U.S. Open champion J.J. Spaun. But Rex, the day at TPC Southwind was about a whole lot more than that. Justin Rose's resurgence at the age of 45, Tommy Fleetwood's latest near miss, the race for the top 50, this had a little bit of everything.
It really did. Give me the two tournaments you have ahead of it, just out of curiosity. I don't want to turn this into a debate, but I'm curious.
The Masters, to me, it's the Masters, then the U.S. Open, which you'll remember like roughly 50 guys had a chance to win on the back nine at Oakmont. That was a great tournament. And then I would put the FedEx St. Jude Championship. Like everything from the back nine, from the drama, the contenders who were trying to win, the race to the top 50, like the dual leaderboards that NBC had going on. Like I absolutely loved it. To me, it was the third best tournament of the year.
Yeah. I mean, I want to give Justin Rose his roses, for lack of a better way of putting it, simply because that's an amazing performance when you consider this has been probably one of his most inconsistent seasons since he turned pro. And that's been a really, really long time. He just hasn't. He has shown flashes, certainly what he did at the Masters, certainly what he has done a couple of times over the course of the season, but it's not what we've come to expect, at least from a ball striking standpoint, the consistency that sort of has dominated his career. So to see this today was interesting, but I think you're right. I mean, I think the part that fascinated me the most coming down the stretch was you had five players play their way in and five players play their way out of the top 50. And we sort of talked about this the last couple of weeks, feeling like even at the Wyndham Championship, I think you and I both agreed that there probably wasn't enough volatility. That if you look at ending up, you only had two players play the way in, two players play their way out.
What do you want to have? Jacked up points? I think that was one idea actually threw out on Golf Today that you need to tinker with the points in the regular season finale just to create some more volatility.
Well, and this is an example, perfect example of jacked up points. It's four times the number of points this week than it was last week and in regular season offenses. So this is what you end up getting. No, you don't want this on the regular season on a week in and week out basis, but it was fun to watch and to see guys grinding it out, see Ricky Fowler know what's on the line, see Jordan Spieth know what's on the line. I was amazed by Chris Kirk. We had this conversation last week when you had a player in Cam Young who broke through for the first time on the PGA Tour and really just rolled over the field on Sunday afternoon, the back nine. And I was a little disappointed, if I'm being honest. Look, I can only imagine how cool it is to walk down the 18th hole with a six-stroke lead to win your first PGA Tour event, but I did feel a little robbed because you do want to see him get tested, having been close so many times. We saw that from Tommy Fleetwood, and we'll get into it, but you also saw it from every single player who was either trying to cling to that spot inside the top 50, and Chris Kirk was the perfect example. He was hitting the ball flawlessly today and suddenly just comes apart on the back nine to fall outside that number. I'm with you. I probably third best is probably right exactly where I would put it because it was captivating for so many different reasons.
Yeah, I feel like we have to start with Justin Rose because this is a major story. Like, keep in mind, his year could have looked decidedly different had things not gone Roy McIlroy's way and he wasn't able to recover from the double bogeys as he did on Sunday at Augusta National. This guy amazes me. Rex, at the age of 45, he's the oldest winner on the PGA Tour since Phil Mickelson won that major championship when he was over the age of 50 at the PGA Championship in 2021. Justin Rose is 45 years old. If you look at statistically, there's no reason why he should continue to be as competitive as he is in the big moments. Like statistically, he's 120th in strokes gained total, which takes into account the complete aspects of a player's game. And yet he just somehow has it. He still has it. 25 years after his professional career began, he still has it. The PGA Championship last year, he was inside the top 10. The Open Championship last year, he pushed Xander Schauffele, among others, all the way to the finish line at Royal Troon. The Masters, it certainly looked like he was going to be his moment throughout the entirety of that week. And now he wins a playoff event against the best and the brightest and the strongest and the fittest and the youngest 69 best players on the PGA Tour this season. This is a player in Justin Rose who I think at this age, everyone would have expected him. Maybe he'd go to live and just sort of be on the Sunset Tour with Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter and Henrik Stenson. But no, he's just sort of doubled down and recommitted himself. We all know about like the dedication he has to fitness. He's got the hyperbaric chambers. He's got a team of physiotherapists who are trying to make him, extend this level of golf for as long as they can. And I'll never forget something he said at the Masters this year, where everyone asked him, like, how much longer do you want to do this? Or why do you still want to do this? And he said, I still know that I love this game because I go out at night at 6 o'clock and play by myself. And when I don't want to do that, and when I don't want to put in the work, and when I don't want to grind for it, that's when I'm going to know that I no longer can do it. But until that time comes, and until I get to a point where I don't want to go out at 6 o'clock by myself and just go play golf because I love to do that, then I'm going to keep doing it. And now he's won a PGA Tour FedEx Cup playoff event. He doesn't seem to be slowing down, at least at the big events, anytime soon. Week-to-week consistency, yeah, I think that's probably a product of age and sort of conserving himself. But he can still show up with the best of them when the light's the brightest.
I'm with you. He's got the goods, for lack of a better term. You look at what he did just coming down the stretch today, and he played his last 8 holes. That includes the 8 playoff holes, and 6 under par. His average approach proximity on those last 8 holes was about 13 feet. So he is still one of the PGA Tour's most sublime ball strikers. Now, they kept playing 18 a couple of times, so he did get into a bit of a rhythm there. But it's just what he was able to do under the most pressure. And to your point, is there any way that he doesn't have the goods at the Ryder Cup next month? It seems like he is built for this. He's built for those moments, even in this little microcosm that was TPC Southwind, and it was this event that was going on in a million degree temperatures and humidity that was off the charts. You have Chance of USA, 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 and he was even feeding off of that a month early. So you get an idea of what this is going to mean to him. You're absolutely right. When you look at, you're not going to like the way I'm going to try to turn this conversation, because you don't particularly like Hall of Fame conversations, but this is his 12th PGA Tour victory.
He is a surefire, no doubt about it, Hall of Famer. Yes.
Oh, I thought you were going to push back on that one. No. He's got 12 PGA Tour victories. Obviously, he has the U.S. Open as the major to put it in there. We have had these conversations before, because I always use Fred Couples as sort of the tent pole when it comes to, if Fred Couples is in the Hall of Fame, that seems like a good litmus test. Let's say it's the Hall of Fame, golf's Hall of Fame's Mendoza line, for lack of a better term. That's 15 PGA Tour victories. That's a Players' Championship. That's a Masters. I'm not quite sure if Rosie is there, but if you factor in what he has done in Europe, which they did many, many times, they certainly did it for Colin Morikawa. If you factor in what he has meant to the Ryder Cup, I'm with you. I think he is a Hall of Famer. And when he's able to do this, and he even kind of referenced it when he spoke with Damon Heck, and we're going to have Damon on later in the show to talk about the interview. I thought it was a really good interview, because I have never really seen Justin Rose emotional very often. He's a very analytical person. As you pointed out, he does everything by the books.
He's very, very pragmatic, very reasonable. Yes. And yet he was pretty emotional afterward,
which is really interesting to me. And he even kind of shied away from the idea at 45 years old, because even he doesn't want to make it about age. I was stunned, though, when this stat came up. He is the first player to win this year on the PGA Tour who was over 40 years old.
I mean, that speaks to where this game is going.
Yeah.
Right. They look a whole lot more like Aldrich Pottgeter than they do Justin Rose. You know, guys who absolutely bash it, they may be a little bit one-dimensional with their skill set, but by and large, they have a lot of speed, a lot of power, a lot of distance. And then if they can sort of get hot with the putter 1 week, or maybe they can refine some of their wedge play for a week, and they can pop up and win a golf tournament. Justin Rose, I think, is going to struggle on a week-to-week basis on the PGA Tour, trying to win shootout tournaments. You know, they're going to be 20 under par, just the nature of his game, the nature of his competition. But when you do have the stiffest test, and I would argue that TPC Southwind was one of the stiffest tests that they had, not just because of the fresh greens that they have to redo at TPC Southwind, but also they grew the Bermuda rough. And so you actually had a penalty for missing the fairway, which, you know, by and large, week in and week out on the PGA Tour, you don't typically see that. And so there's certainly going to be tests throughout the year that are more conducive to Justin Rose's success than others. TPC Southwind played right into that, even against, you know, again, a PGA Tour. These are the top 69 players of the year. It's supposed to be 70. Rory McIlroy didn't play. I mean, that's the best the PGA Tour has to offer, and Justin Rose is the champion, and it certainly didn't look like a fluke.
And I will say, you talk about longevity, and he is just one of two players who have played in 18 of the 19 playoffs. No one has played in all 19 of them. So you get an idea. He has been here since pretty much the beginning. And the idea that he's going against the Pottgeters of the world. You're right. Shows that he still not only has the goods, for lack of a better term, but he's also driven. And that's the part I think that he kind of got into with Damon. I'm kind of interested to hear his comments after the round about how this is the thing that gets him motivated. You're right. I don't think he gets motivated week in and week out to play your random PGA Tour event, but this one certainly got him excited.
It, just to button up your Hall of Fame, he was a Hall of Famer, in my opinion, before he won in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And I think the only mystery was going to be who was going to get in first. Was it going to be Justin Rose, or was it going to be some of his peers, who I think all of whom were born within 6 months of each other, with Sergio Garcia and Adam Scott as well. I think all three of those are probably Hall of Famers. To me, Justin Rose was the most likely to get in. You look at the quality of his wins, the caliber, the golf courses that he's winning on, the Olympic medal, the Ryder Cup resume. To me, he's one of the best players of his generation. It's great to see him again playing deep into his 40s as he is and still very competitive. He's absolutely going to be a thorn in the side of the Americans at Bethpage Black. That much is to be sure. How about a note, Rex, on JJ Spahn, who lost in the playoff? And boy, you look at what could have been in the playoff with Rory McIlroy at the Players' Championship. Remember that shot on 17 that he thought was perfect, flew right over the flag and said, led to a watery, what was that, a triple in March at the Players' Championship at TPC Sawgrass. Then you look at what happened here, the missed seven-footer on the third playoff hole, lipped out on the first playoff hole. In another universe, and Scottie Scheffler was not born, and there was different results or different outcomes on some of those shots that JJ Spahn hit. Like, JJ Spahn very easily could have been the player of the year in 2025. It's an unbelievable story to think of a guy who 56 weeks ago thought about retiring and that his PGA Tour career was over. And now he's inside the top five in the official World Golf ranking. He's already secured a spot on the U.S. Ryder Cup team. He's now a major champion, and he's pushing potentially Hall of Fame players like Justin Rose all the way to the finish line.
Outside the top 90 in FedEx Cup points at this point last year. You're right. He was sort of second-guessing his life choices. What am I going to do? Like, this doesn't seem to be working out. And it wasn't even until late in the fall that he was able to secure his playing privileges for this year. And it is interesting to see how that has turned so dramatically for him. And this is a stat that during the height of Tiger Woods' career, I always worked hard to come up with a way to quantify this, because the one thing Tiger Woods seemed to do better than anyone else, well, he did a lot of things better than anyone else, but the one thing that impressed me the most was his ability to understand clutch putting. Like, he didn't make every putt, but he made every putt he needed to. And I'll say the same thing about JJ Spahn. He doesn't make every putt, but it seems like he is so good when it comes to the moment. You go back to the 72nd green, of course, at the U.S. Open and at Oakmont. He didn't need to make that putt, but it certainly made for a pretty dramatic finish. You look at what he did today at TPC Southwinds. That was understanding the moment. That was being in the heat of it against a really good field, against a really good opponent. All of those things are very impressive. And you're right, to go from zero, where he was pretty much last year, to where he is right now is impressive. They talked about it on the telecast quite a bit, about what has clicked inside him really over the last 12 months. And there certainly is more confidence there. And in coming off of that U.S. Open victory, I think both you and I had a chance to talk with his swing coach, Adam Shriver, just about how he started viewing himself differently. He started viewing himself as a player that deserved to be in those conversations when it comes to winning major championship, playing in Ryder Cup, being in the top 10 in the world ranking. That's an entirely different mindset that he's come to very, very quickly.
His iron play is one of the best on the PGA Tour. As we all know, that's sort of the hallmark of what the best players do well week in and week out on the PGA Tour. A strong iron player is typically going to have success. He certainly improved his putting since he switched to this lab putter. It looks a little bit unsightly, but it certainly helped him. Ricky Fowler, who we're going to get into in a second as well. The reason why I love this story, Rex, is that even JJ Spahn is having a difficult time sort of rationalizing or comprehending what's actually going on, because he is very much, you know, sort of he's in the prime of his career, but as we just mentioned, he's sort of late stage bloomer. And he said afterward on Sunday in Memphis that, quote, "I don't know what's gotten into me," end quote. He's just sort of content with what he's done in the game. And he called it sort of a free rolling attitude, which is a very dangerous spot if you're going up against JJ Spahn, because the guy's got nothing to lose. He's sort of already exceeded his own expectations, certainly for 2025 season. But again, this was a player who last summer, when he was well outside the top 125 and just needing points just to secure his playing privileges, sort of felt a level of contentment about his entire career at that point. Made a bunch of money. He'd already won once. He made a bunch of friends, had top tens. Like he was set for life at that point. Then you put on top of that a career year, as he said, in 2025, and J.J. Spawn certainly looks like a very imposing, very dangerous player. What do you think, Rex, about this? We saw it in Canada, this new playoff twist that the PGA Tour has rolled out, where they simply just cut a new hole location on 18. We saw it in Canada. I don't ever recall seeing it there. And then it was just sort of a quick and easy shift that they had on 18 at TPC Southwind ahead of the third playoff hole. Justin Rose was able to capitalize with his birdie putt. J.J. Spawn, not so much.
I was going to bring this up because we've had these conversations throughout the year a couple of times. I think at the Scottish Open, it came up, and maybe the Canadian Open as well, where we ended up having playoffs. And there's a couple of, there's two ways to do it. All right. At the Scottish Open, the playoff format would have been 18-18, 6-6, 18. I know that sounds kind of weird, but it has to do with the routing of the golf course and getting guys where they needed them to go. But most tournament directors, and this came up at the Canadian Open because they kept sort of bouncing around to different holes. Most tournament directors would rather them just stay at 18 because that's where all the people are. That's where the infrastructure is. That's where you're going to get the best scene. That's where all the TV cameras are. So it just makes sense. From a competitive standpoint, I think three holes is fine. We have seen in the past where you've had a playoff like this that stays on the 18th and just goes for four or five or six holes. Then it gets monotonous. And that's, I think it came up like 2 years ago, and that's why they started to cut the new holes on the greens, just mixing it up, trying to give a different feel to it. I'm not quite sure if that really helped at all because it was still the exact same tee shot. It was a very, very similar approach shot. Maybe the putt, obviously the putt was a little bit different, but I'm not sure it changes anything other than the optics of it. I think it's just tournament officials trying to make it look different as best they can, because logistically you just can't have fans racing all over the golf course trying to catch up with a playoff. So I understand why they do it, but it can certainly get a little boring.
Yeah, remember a couple years ago with Will Zalatoris, he had that wacky playoff. Sepp Straka was involved as well. That included the 11th hole.
Yeah, we circled all the way back around. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as a journalist who has covered many playoffs, and I'm always racing trying to beat the crowd so I could watch the action unfold. Like I think I love this tweak. It makes it different. The tee shot and obviously the approach shot are very similar, but just gives them some other added challenge while also keeping all the infrastructure in place in the 72nd hole of the tournament. I do like that. I do want to point that out. Somehow, Rex, we've gone 17 and a half minutes without talking about what was probably the story of the day. And that's no disrespect to Justin Rose, but I think a lot of people were focused on who Justin Rose was playing with. And that was Tommy Fleetwood, who has the most top threes, the most top fives, and the most top tens on the PGA Tour of anyone without a win over the last 40 years. Unfortunately for Tommy, after his finish, he is still winless on the PGA Tour. We talked a lot about the Travelers Championship, right? He was three up with four to go. This one, TPC Southwind, he was up two with three to go. Which one hurts more for Tommy Fleetwood?
I don't know that either one of them hurt more or less than the others. I think they're just painful for him at this point. They both hurt really bad. And I will say this, it was a similar formula to what we saw at the Travelers Championship, where he kind of gets off to a slow start. He got sort of stuck in neutral, tried to fight his way out of it there towards the end of the round, and then just stumbled. And this is what I was sort of alluding to last week when it comes to Cameron Young. It's really hard to win on the PGA Tour. I think sometimes we oversimplify it and we downplay how difficult it actually is, because it happens week in and week out. I understand that. But if you're a player like Tommy Fleetwood or Cam Young, there's absolutely no part of your game that you can point to and say, well, that's going to keep me from winning. Because those things don't exist. In a perfect world, Tommy Fleetwood can putt with the best of them on the PGA Tour. Certainly his ball striking is as good as anyone not named Scott. So there's not, if you were just going to look at his resume and look at what he does statistically so well, there's not one thing you would point at and say, yep, he's not going to be able to get it done. This is the mental challenges of just trying to get over the hurdle. I think this is what Rory McIlroy was sort of alluding to going into the Masters this year, that he had tried to come up with so many different scenarios in his mind to make the Masters mean something less than it actually was, and he couldn't do it. It wasn't until he probably actually just embraced it. And let's just see if I can do it. Let's see if I can stumble across the finish line and get one done. I tend to agree with a lot of the announcers, because you sort of heard this a lot on Sunday afternoon, that he will get that first PGA Tour victory. Also, it's important to point out, he has seven wins on the DP World Tour. It's not as though he's not an accomplished player worldwide.
But I think that's
he also won 5-0 at the Ryder Cup paired with Molinari. back in Paris. So he is a very accomplished player. I'm not quite sure at the end of his career, if he doesn't get across his finish line, he's going to be destroyed. But certainly there is something there that he's going to have to wrestle with. And you saw it again on this Sunday, just like we saw it on Sunday at the Travelers Championship.
But isn't that confusing? Because, you know, last week with Cameron Young breaking through for the first time at the Wyndham Championship, he had 7 runner-up finishes. That was the most on the PGA Tour since they began keeping those statistics in 1983. But Cam Young had played well in those final round performances, and he had just gotten beat. Like, his final round scoring average was 67.5. Like, the dude was lighting it up. It just wasn't his time. I know not all runner-up finishes are created equal. Tommy Fleetwood's, though, is different. His final round performances, he's never gone out and had one really stolen from him. Like, I think back to the U.S. Open, shot 63, but Brooks Koepka wasn't going to surrender that one, not at that time with Brooks Koepka. That was the closest, in my opinion, that Tommy Fleetwood has gotten. But he had, you know, he didn't play particularly well in Canada when Nick Taylor dropped that bomb on him in the playoff. That wasn't not necessarily a great final round performance. Certainly what happened at the Travelers Championship at TPC River Highlands just a couple of months ago was not a great finish. And this, I don't think, was anything that he'd be particularly proud about either, the way that he played. You know, it was very so-so for the first 11 holes. He was leading the field in greens and regulation and driving accuracy over the first 3 days. And all of a sudden he was missing left with that little mini driver that he had, you know, wielded so successfully. He was still very much in the mix. And then he got hot in the middle of the round. Birdies 12, birdies 13, makes a great two putt par on 14. Then birdies 15. All of a sudden, it is his golf tournament. He has a lot of confidence. And then I still don't quite know. We're recording this a couple hours after the final round ended. I still don't quite know, Rex, what went wrong. Because he's in the driver's seat in the middle of 16 fairway, a very easy par 5, the easiest hole on the golf course, hits what appears to be a decent approach shot into the par 5, but just sort of skitters long. What happened with that third shot and not leaving himself a realistic shot to make birdie, to me, was the biggest error. Instead, just bones it over the green on the other side and actually does well just to escape with a par. 17, he's in the fairway. I think he said he had mud on his ball for his approach shot. Another very poor pitch shot. And then all of a sudden hits the worst putt of his entire week, where he was up and out of it from 8 feet almost immediately. I commend him for talking. We're going to have Damon Hack on here shortly, and I want to ask him about that interview. But this one really has to hurt. I think this one he's going to be searching for, like, what did I do wrong? Or what could I have done better to correct for next time? Because it doesn't seem immediately clear for me. I mean, he's standing in the middle of 16 fairway. The tournament's in his grasp. And then all of a sudden it's gone.
I think any sports psychologist will tell you, Bob Rotella, will tell you that in those situations, just look for whatever your tendencies are. And you just went over at least the most recent two, you know, finishes that you're going to point at and say, yes, something went wrong there. And the tendency is, normally being such a good ball striker, it doesn't, nerves, wanting something too much, feeling the pressure of the moment, whatever it is you want to call it, doesn't necessarily manifest itself in a full shot. Normally it's something small. It's a chip shot, it's a putt, something along those lines. That's just sort of the general idea when you look at sports psychology. I think that specific, you could argue coming down the stretch, is what got to him, because the up and downs, the putts that he had been sinking pretty much all week long. And look, even Saturday was a grind for him. It's not as though he was in full sail during that third round either. And he was able to convert those little delicate shots under the pressure. Coming down the stretch on Sunday, he wasn't able to do it. And if you look at his tendencies, that's what he doesn't do more times than often, certainly on the PGA Tour, that he hasn't been able to get it done. And part of this might be, maybe you just don't get the bounce when you need it. Maybe you didn't have that part of your game when you need it the most. But to your point, I would tend to agree with you here. We made the comments last week about Cameron Young. Those 7 runner-up finishes, by and large, you can point to most of those, maybe not all of them, but most of those, and say that he got beat. Someone else just played better. And that happens on Sunday on the PGA Tour almost all the time. The other half of this is, you could probably make an argument for Tommy Fleetwood and all of those near misses that he has, and he lost. And that's a different conversation. It's a different narrative. And I think you're right. That's what Tommy's going to have to come to grips with. And it's only going to get harder.
I mean, Justin Rose, his fellow playing competitor on Sunday, was magnificent. birding four holes in a row, nearly birdied 18 in regulation, then birdies the 18th hole twice
last eight. Yeah.
In the playoff as well. Like, that's not to take anything away from what Justin Rose did. Tommy Fleetwood, though, made it easier. I think you're exactly right. Where do nerves crop up? Typically, it crops up with speed control on putts. I also think you can make the argument, particularly with those very easy chipping areas with the Zoysia, the touch and the feel with the pitch shots clearly was not there on 16 and 17 when the pressure to get those shots up and down was going to be at its highest.
When I was doing the story, I believe it was 2 years ago, Lucas Glover, he had a breakthrough and he had dealt with, his words, not mine. I hate using this word. I apologize. If you're sensitive, please mute your TV right now. He talked about how he got through having simply the yips when it came to putting. And he started working. Yes, cover your eyes. You don't want to hear this. And he started working with a Navy SEAL who I had an opportunity to just interview for the story as well. And one of the things that he was pointing out in the Navy SEALs, you're taught to load your weapon in a very certain way because you're taught not to use your fingers. You kind of use the palm of your hand and your big muscles and you slap at it, because when you get nervous and your heart starts pumping and those nerves starts to crop up, it's the extremities that start to lose the blood pressure. I mean, start to lose blood that you start to use feeling in it. To your point, that's where speed control comes from. You don't necessarily need that when you have a driver in your hand, but if you're chipping from behind the green like he was on 17 or 16, that's how it manifests itself.
I think it only makes Tommy Fleetwood a more fascinating, a more compelling player to cover. Just how can a player who has 7 DP World Tour wins, who is clearly one of the best players in the world, how come that has not translated to the States in the PGA Tour? I think it only makes it more fast. And this one's clearly going to hurt. Would not surprise me at all, of course, if he puts himself in position to win the BMW Championship again this week. Well, someone who had an opportunity to speak with Tommy Fleetwood immediately afterward, want to ask him about that and plenty more from the final round of the FedEx St. Jude Championship, is Damon Hack, co-host of Golf Today. He'll be joining us on this podcast right after this short break. And for this Boots on the Ground segment, we're pleased to be joined by Damon Hack, who is on the call for NBC Sports at the FedEx St. Jude Championship. And D, I called this the third best tournament of the year. Tell me I'm wrong.
Wow. You're not wrong. I guess, would it be the Masters and, gosh, what would your second one be? Maybe the U.S. Open?
Yes.
Am I right?
It involved a playoff participant. Yes, Masters, U.S. Open, FedEx St. Jude Championship. That's what I believe. I mean, you covered it. You were there. Oh. You were chasing epic. The stories. Do you agree?
I do. I tell you what, if this is what the PGA Tour is looking for in the playoffs, it's exactly what you'd want. You had storylines. You had a great leaderboard. You had a playoff, a legitimate playoff. You had drama. You had what, Spahn goes 65-65 on the weekend. You had 45-year-old Justin Rose shooting 67, making 4 birdies in a row at one point. You had the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, clearing his throat coming off of a couple-week layoff after winning the Claret Jug. You had Tommy Fleetwood in the storyline of heartbreak that continues to follow him even at the age of 34. It had everything that you wanted. Fantastic golf course. It was hot. It was a struggle for the players, and that's what it should be. It should be tough. It should be sticky. It's the playoffs.
We just had an extended conversation about Justin Rose in the Hall of Fame. I'm going to spare you of that. I'm not going to pull you into that. But what did this victory mean for a 45-year-old Justin Rose?
You know, I asked him about the perception of him as this professional, precise, meticulous player. And he said, listen, he's those things, yes, but he also still believes he has great golf in him. And that was the storyline. He hadn't won since 2023. He had the heartbreak at the Masters. It's one thing to contend, but to actually be able to find a way to get the job done, it shows that in his mid-40s, he's still as dangerous as ever, especially in a Ryder Cup year. He told me earlier this week that he's still hungry, highly motivated, and told me years ago that he's looking for that cherry on top of the sundae. Yes, he's a major championship winner. He's won the FedEx Cup. He's won Olympic gold. Now a 12-time winner on the PGA Tour, but he's still looking for one more huge moment. This was a big, big moment for him, but I still think that he wants to win one more major championship, and you've got to believe it's either the Masters or a Claret Jug for Justin Rose down the road.
Justin Rose, Hall of Fame, book it. Damon, when I finished watching the coverage of regulation and NBC went to break, I turned to my wife and said, the one thing that I want to hear is Damon Hack interviewing Tommy Fleetwood. I wasn't sure that he was going to speak with you after what was yet another agonizing near miss, but you got him. As a reporter, can you take us behind the scenes? What's that like, sort of gearing up for what you know is probably going to be a very sensitive interview with a subject who's clearly disappointed by the result?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is always sensitive when you interview someone who's had their dreams dashed, especially Tommy, who had the heartbreak at Travelers and, you know, had 6 runner-up finishes, 42 top 10 finishes before this week in Memphis. And thankfully, I've interviewed Tommy a lot through the years, know him a little bit as reporters know players. Don't know him well, but I've interviewed him a lot through the years, and had interviewed him a lot, you know, this past week in Memphis, you know, after his great play on Thursday and Friday. He was happy to see me. I was happy to see him. You try to, you know, be gentle with your questions. And I was, especially on Sunday, knowing the storyline. Everybody on property knew the storyline. You know, my producer Tommy Roy said we have to ask for Tommy. I was comfortable asking for him. I was very grateful that he wanted to talk. Didn't have to. If he turned me down, I wouldn't have thought any less of him, even as a reporter, though I want to talk to the players in victory and in defeat. And so I tried to be sensitive and still ask the tough questions. And I said, you know, you've talked about the challenges of trying to win, the frustration, and how would you describe the emotion? And he talked about it. He was obviously gutted. And I asked him, where did it go wrong? Because it looked like everything was going right when he birdied 12 and, you know, birdied 13, had the big par save at 14, another birdie at 15. It was like, this is Tommy's moment. And you were hearing shouts of Tommy Ladd. And there were a lot of Memphians that were rooting for Tommy Fleetwood. And when he did, you know, not make the playoff and had this disappointment and talked to me, I got to be honest, I got more text messages about that interview than the interview with Justin Rose. People connect to disappointment. We love the victory stories, but I tell you what, the public wants to hear from players and teams and athletes when they struggle. It makes them more human. And everyone that sent me a text message was like, man, I love this guy. I can't wait for the moment when he does win. I think it humanizes the players. I mean, you guys grew up and remember the old this ABC, you know, thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. I mean, we grew up with that kind of, you know, etched into our minds. And as sports fans and as journalists, we want to hear not just from the victor, but also from those who are gutted. And Tommy, you know, gratefully and showing much class, you know, spent a lot of time with me and answered 2 questions and was very long-winded. You could tell that he was heartbroken, but I really appreciated him taking the time to chat with me.
I love that point, Damon, because we talked a lot earlier in the year. Colin Morikawa, of course, at Bay Hill after he ended up losing there, didn't want to speak with the media. And I'm with you. I totally understand it. Or if you want to take 15 or 20 minutes as a cooling off period, I understand that. They don't have an obligation to speak to us. But when they do, you end up with these great storylines. And I would argue that one of the best interviews I've ever sat in was Phil Mickelson when he blew it at Wingfoot, just because of the emotion and the honesty that came out of him. After speaking with Tommy, where do you think he is in his mind about what he needs to do to break through?
Yeah, he said he's going to spend a lot of time, Rex, thinking about that very question, because he was close. Again, it was in his control. At least it looked like that. On the back nine, especially after he birdied 3 out of 4 holes, had the good par save. It looked like the lid had come off. He kind of struggled, he said, on the front nine, didn't really have anything going. So it's going to be time for him to reflect. I love what he said earlier in the week. He said, I'd rather have been in contention and lost than to never have been in contention at all. He's going to have to lean on that sentiment. He's going to have to lean on it, cling to it, believe that for him to get out of what has obviously been just a tough stretch. He's playing so well. He's 3rd in scoring average behind only Scotty and Rory. He played great golf this week. Didn't birdie 16, made the bogey on 17. There are a few things that are happening down the stretch that he has to tighten up, whether he's not playing, you know, in the normal pre-shot routine. We saw him kind of, you know, at the Travelers take a lot of time, a little indecision with his caddy. Maybe that's something he has to work on. Didn't really make any glaring mistakes. Sometimes someone else is going to make the mistake. He has to continue to put himself there. I agree with that. And maybe at some point it'll be somebody else making the bogey and he makes the par or the miraculous birdie. But I think he has to lean on his optimism, lean on the fact that he knows he's playing great golf right now, and lean on the fact that he has to believe that one day the chips will fall in his favor.
Damon, I was filling your seat last week on Golf Today alongside Eamon Lynch, and all week I was spreading the gospel of the FedEx St. Jude Championship and why, in my opinion, it's one of the very best tournaments on the entire PGA Tour schedule, because you don't just have the tournament that was won by Justin Rose. You also have the tournament within the tournament, trying to get inside the top 50 in FedEx Cup points, get to the signature events in 2026. As a reporter, as a journalist, how are you sort of balancing all of the competing storylines that were unfolding Sunday at TPC Southwind?
Yeah, really trying to pay attention to both the top of the leaderboard and that all-important 50 bubble. You know, we kind of came on the air. Jordan Spieth was a huge story. You know, where would he end up? Would this be the last time we see him unless he wants to play in the fall to try to improve his standing? Ricky Fowler, we almost interviewed Ricky, but when he was finishing his round, it was like right in the heat of the moment when you had Scheffler and Rose and Spahn and Fleetwood all kind of jousting for the top spot on the leaderboard. So that was the story we were paying attention to. And it does add tension and gravitas to this event. It's the playoffs. I like the shortened field. I always felt like everybody can't make the playoffs. In other sports, teams make the playoffs, teams miss the playoffs. So I'm glad even as the PGA Tour, part of its charge is to create playing opportunities. The playoffs in sports historically have been sacrosanct. They're hard to make. It sucks when you miss out on the playoffs. And I love the fact that it's a little bit tighter, a little more tension at the Wyndham, more tension in Memphis. And that storyline to make it in the top 50, to be able to set your schedule and be in those signature events, was, if not top of mind, you know, the leaderboard and who was going to win was top of mind, but that 50 number was on all of our minds for all of Sunday.
And it was an embarrassment of riches. It just wasn't the top 50. It just wasn't the top of the leaderboard. You did a walk and talk with Andrew Novak on Saturday that I thought was fascinating, because you asked him about the Ryder Cup and how that is on his mind. And he said exactly what you would expect him to say. I'm not thinking about that. I'm just trying to play well. Do you believe that? Because every player is going to say the same thing. They're all going to pretend like it doesn't exist. But you don't believe that, do you?
Oh, they can't help it. Wherever they turn, it's everywhere. They're even hearing chants of USA, USA throughout the weekend. And it was funny with Andrew, who I saw before he hit his tee shot. He kind of gave me a nod, like acknowledging that we were about to do this walk and talk. It's Saturday afternoon, big time event, FedEx Cup playoffs. And then he hits his tee shot to the right into the rough. And before the interview started, he said, man, I thought if I agreed to do this walk and talk that I'd have the golf gods and the karma in my direction, and I'd easily hit the fairway. And, of course, he ends up missing that fairway to the right. But these guys, I tell you, so much to play for. They can't avoid the conversation about this bubble and that bubble, FedEx Cup bubbles and Ryder Cup bubbles. And he said, listen, I'm just trying to win this golf tournament. If I win this golf tournament, all that talk about Ryder Cup this and impressing Keegan Bradley that will take care of itself. But it's fascinating. It's in the air. Everybody feels it. Everybody senses it. It's a lot of stress. And that's what you want during this time of the year. You want storylines, and you want the golfers having to either rise to the occasion or perhaps being overwhelmed by these big moments.
I got to ask you, Damon, because one of the big storylines heading into the FedEx St. Jude Championship was which American player was going to sort of establish himself as a guy that Keegan Bradley couldn't possibly leave off the roster. I'm not sure if we necessarily had that answer, but you did have a Cameron Young, the top five finish. You did have Andrew Novak, Patrick Cantlay, Ben Griffin, all finished inside the top 10 of an event that was pitting the very best 69 players of the PGA Tour season against each other. Whose stock do you think most improved with their performance at TPC Southwind that Keegan Bradley had to have taken notice of?
I think it's Cameron Young coming off the win at the Wyndham and continuing to play great golf. And to hear the guys on the broadcast talking about how his putter has come to life. When you've got the likes of Brad Faxon and Kevin Kisner, two great putters, talking about how well that Cameron is rolling the rock. How can you not take the New Yorker, who won as an amateur the Met Open? He shot a course record at the time, a 64, before Brooks Koepka broke it in the PGA Championship. He's big, he's strong, hits the ball a long way. He is playing his best golf right now, which is what you want, that old heat index, which we had the old Billy Horschel rule back in the day. That's why you have these moments late in the season, so that Keegan Bradley can say, I want that guy, because he's confident, he's playing well, hits the ball a mile, and the putter for Cameron Young is looking very, very strong. So I think he's a no-brainer. He's got the demeanor, doesn't show much, knows the golf course well. I think Cameron Young, even not winning this week, continue to play well. I think his stock is very, very high. And I think Keegan Bradley will take great notice of that.
I wanted to ask you about one of those guys that will probably be on the team with Cam Young as we get closer and closer to the Ryder Cup matches. At this point last year, JJ Spahn was outside the top 90. He wasn't even sure if he was going to have a tour card coming into this season. How did he find this new gear? What have you seen out of him that just has blown you away, other than winning the U.S. Open, doing what he did at the Players, doing what he's done this summer?
Tell you what, JJ Spahn is a baller. I mean, to see him walking stride for stride, shoulder to shoulder, with the world number one and Scottie Scheffler, to see JJ's crew, had his wife, Melody, had his coaches, Adam Shriver and Josh Gregory, living and dying with every hole during that playoff. Listen, he came to Memphis with a confidence level between 1 and 10. He said it about a 2 after what he said was a pretty kind of quiet trip to the UK. Didn't play that great at the Scottish and in the Open, and felt like his golf swing was out of whack. Found something with his coaches, and to be able to put it into play, it looked like for a long time he was going to win this golf tournament. JJ Spahn, to me, the putts that he makes, and when he doesn't make them, they're all scaring the hole. You make a 64-footer at the U.S. Open at Oakmont, and suddenly the hole looks like a big bucket. He's playing with so much confidence. You mentioned the Players, the U.S. Open, and now these playoffs. JJ Spahn looks like he belongs. Had I interviewed him afterwards, had he won this tournament, I said, JJ, you are suddenly looking like a man for these moments. How do you go from a year ago saying, well, I've had maybe a nice PGA Tour career, this could be it, to now one of the best players in the world, a Ryder Cup lock, and looking utterly comfortable alongside the likes of Scotty and the Fleetwoods and the Justin Roses of the world? Very, very impressive. He's a very confident player right now.
How about the player, Damon, that JJ Spahn was paired with on Sunday in Scottie Scheffler? A little bit of a strange week. He struggled with his driver, the opening couple of rounds, couldn't buy a putt on Sunday, had a fill-in caddy, Brad Payne, filling in for Ted Scott, who was dealing with a personal matter back home in Louisiana. It's not often that Scottie Scheffler gets a share of the lead and does not win the golf tournament. I think back to the Texas Open earlier this year, we lost to Minwoo Lee. What was your takeaway from Scotty getting up there and also stumbling a little bit on the back nine?
Yeah, I mean, Scotty's being measured now like Tiger was being measured. You know, if he doesn't win, you kind of look a little bit, is everything okay? What's wrong? I mean, I'm giving Scotty Scheffler a pass. You know, he was off for a couple of weeks. He won the Claret Jug. He's lived inside the top 10, hasn't had a finish outside of it since like March. He's on this incredible streak of great play. I think the off course distraction with someone he cares about in Ted Scott, who had to attend to a family matter. He had his good friend and mentor, Brad Payne, on the bag, which I think obviously was a comfortable group for him, a comfortable teammate, as it were, to walk the fairways with him. Just didn't quite, you know, have the driver tightened up enough. I thought he rolled the rock beautifully. I'm going to give the man a pass. He's the best player in the world without question, a dominant world number one, dominant FedEx number one. It's not always going to be the guy, you know, taking home the trophy on Sunday. He has 4 huge wins this season. I think it was more of a kind of, how do you compartmentalize what's going on off the course? We don't know exactly what that is. And then trying to perform at the highest level against the best players in the world inside the ropes.
Lav and I batted this one around last week, and I'd love to get your thoughts on the idea that you're absolutely right. Scottie Scheffler, even this week, didn't win, but he is still the standard. He's still the mountain, as Xander Schauffele has said time and time again, that everyone is trying to climb, and it only seems to be getting more and more steep. What, if anything, slows him down at this point? We've seen him deal with injuries a little bit, but it doesn't seem to distract him. It doesn't seem to hold him down for very long. Is there anything that you think that could slow him down?
The only thing that would slow him down is if he suddenly became bored of winning. And he doesn't strike me as the type who's going to be bored of winning. I think he truly loves the process. And I think he, you know, he opened up a lot of our eyes with his comments at the Open Championship before winning the Open Championship, that winning isn't everything to him. He'll enjoy it for a couple of minutes. Then it's all about being a better husband, better father, family man, friend. And I think he believes that. I think he can do both. But when he's inside the ropes, it's all about business. It's all about process. It's all about getting better. And I do believe that you can be both. I think he was just saying, listen, when it's time to go to work and punch the clock, I'm going to be locked in. And we see the frustration sometimes. He's not one to not slam a club or look askance and look upset or be a little bit short-tempered from time to time. But he's also able to put those things away when it's time to be a dad and time to be a husband. I think the only thing that would slow him down would be injury or boredom. But this is someone who it's remarkable how he could have such a big win at the Open Championship, take a couple of weeks off, come to Memphis and just slowly build. You could see the build day by day, one shot better, another shot better, the putter a little better. The driver was just a little bit off this week, and you can't play from the rough at TPC Southwind. It's something the players said all week long. But Scottie Scheffler, much like Tiger Woods before him, loves the process, loves to win, and I believe will continue to find goals and ways to push himself forward and will not be bored of winning anytime soon.
Tiger Woods, Scottie Scheffler, Damon Hack, three guys who never get tired of winning. D, you and I are going to be sparring partners on Golf Today, hosted by Rex Hoggard and Eamon Lynch. We always appreciate you taking the time on the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll talk to you down the road.
Rex and Lav, you're the best. Thanks so much.
All right. More of the podcast and some final thoughts coming up after this short break. All right, Rex, let's close out this episode with some winners and losers from the FedEx St. Jude Championship. In your opinion, who's the biggest winner?
Well, Justin Rose, like I said, let's give as many flowers as we possibly can. That's a pretty impressive performance.
Besides Justin Rose, maybe JD.
We did 17 minutes on Justin Rose. Try again. I understand what you're saying. I'm going to go back to the top 50 bubble for all the reasons that we talked about. This is such a pivotal event. It's just not a number. Top 50 is so important to these players because that gets you into the signature events next year. It essentially allows you to set your schedule. And as we've seen now over 2 years, we have enough of a case study to look at it. You've got to play really, really poorly. If you're in every signature event, you're probably in the players as well. You're definitely in the players as well. You're probably in the four major championships. So you already have an advantage going against everyone else. So if you look at what a player like a Bud Colley did and his story, we've told a couple times now, but it's pretty amazing. Everything that he has been through, the multiple injuries, the horrific car crash, all of the struggles that he has had to be able to have that Sunday like he had. And again, I'll go to the PGA Tour and give them a compliment on this front. Four times the points seems like a good formula because it allows this type of movement. I thought that was really impressive as far as a winner goes. On the loser's side, I'm going to go twofold. I'm going to steer probably who you wanted. I'm going to go with Jordan Spieth because he simply didn't get it done on Sunday. And he was a guy who early in the week was talking about trying to get Keegan Bradley's attention for the Ryder Cup. And instead, he didn't even make it to the second playoff event. And Wyndham Clark, it's been such a weird season for him. It's been up and down. You and I kind of talked about this on the podcast a little bit. When it comes to Jordan Spieth, we have addressed this, that most of the sponsor exemptions are going to into the signature events are going to go to a Jordan Spieth or a Ricky Fowler. Understandable. That's who you want in your field. I'll be curious to see how many go to Wyndham Clark next year.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I'm with you along the same lines. Wyndham Clark, Jordan Spieth, they could probably kiss the Ryder Cup aspirations goodbye, having failed to advance to the second playoff event. I would also throw in like a player like Jake Knapp, who had multiple chances to win golf tournaments on the PGA Tour in 2025, was unable to get it done, then ended up tying for 62nd in Memphis in a week. He absolutely had to have it. So I think that was certainly disappointing for Jake Knapp. It's sort of a rising star who sort of needs to elevate and sort of alter his career trajectory if he really wants to be a big star on the tour. For the biggest winner along the same lines that you just mentioned is Ricky Fowler, in my opinion. This is a player who tied for sixth at TPC Southwind. We have been as critical as anyone of the PGA Tour stance of allowing sponsor exemptions into signature events just because of the benefit they could potentially give players who are receiving them when it's supposed to be the ultimate meritocracy. No player was gifted more sponsor exemptions than Ricky Fowler would, but he also, Rex, put in the work this summer, playing golf tournaments he hasn't played in ages. He's playing the 3M. He was playing the Rocket Mortgage. He was playing the John Deere Classic, all in an effort to gain points. It pays off now by getting inside the top 50, getting into the BMW Championship. He is now exempt into those events. And people are still going to bicker. People are still going to talk about, well, he shouldn't have been in that position if he wasn't given those spots. Those are the rules that were set in 2025. And in the week that he absolutely had to get it done, Ricky Fowler played some of his best golf of the year. Hats off to Ricky, who is now in the signature events in 2026 and no longer needs those spots. Final punch shot for today. John Rahm, Rex, quite surprisingly, lost in a playoff to Dean Burmester. He was also with Jose Le Ballesteros at LIV Chicago, the second to last event on the LIV schedule. How surprised are you that John Rahm, the former world number one and Masters champion, is heading into the final individual championship without a win on his docket in 2025?
You and I went back and forth earlier about the idea of Tommy Fleetwood and how much did this impact him? Did it not impact him? And what seems to be missing? And we could talk a lot about what Tommy Fleetwood brings to the table. That I can explain. I can't explain John Rahm not winning on LIV Golf. That makes absolutely no sense to me. To be fair to John Rahm, he's given himself plenty of opportunities. To be fair to John Rahm, he's actually played better in the major championships this year than he did last year when he probably got his share of criticism because of what everyone thought. That's exactly what's going to happen when you go to LIV Golf. I did not think that was a fair take. I think John Rahm was still a world-class player when he went, and he still is now that he's over at LIV Golf. But it is stunning to me to the extreme, not just because of the level of competition. There's plenty of good players on LIV Golf, but we know what John Rahm is. He is a proven commodity, and the fact that he had an opportunity today to do it again and lost in a playoff, shocking.
Joaquin Niemann is the player that I thought John Rahm was going to be on LIV Golf, a player who consistently wins 3, 4, 5 times and absolutely dominates his competition. And even on the weeks that he doesn't win, he's up there a la Scottie Scheffler. The fact that he hasn't won is shocking and one of the biggest stories, in my opinion, of 2025. The way that he lost in LIV Chicago on Sunday was also sort of an indictment of John Rahm. Standing up on the tee, trying to hit that big peeler fade that he typically hits, ends up hitting it dead straight into the junk, does well just to make par. Where it has gone wrong, I think it's probably going to require a little bit of soul searching. He's just not sharp enough at this point. It's incredible to say that Joaquin Niemann has surpassed him as a player, at least in LIV. Certainly the major championships is another story. All right, you are in Connecticut, Rex, this week for Golf Today alongside Eamon Lynch. I'll be joining on the roundtable on Monday. Certainly looking forward to that. In the meantime, you guys know the drill, nbcsports.com/golf, aka golfchannel.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys on Wednesday afternoon.